the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Rock historian, critic, and journalist Evelyn McDonnell is my guest. She's the author of Mamarama, a memoir of sex, kids, and rock and roll, Army of She, Icelandic, Iconoclastic, Irrepressible Björk, and lots of other stuff. Her new book is Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. Evelyn McDonnell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Runaways were among the first women in rock to flaunt their sexuality. And at the time, it seemed like a choice that female artists could make. But I think now it seems inevitable. I notice that even Taylor Swift is like sporting Runaways-style hot pants in her latest tour. Is the sexploitation of women in rock part of the Runaways' legacy?
Well, it could be the unfortunate part of their legacy, yes, and that was always the sort of feminist fear of what they would launch with Cherie Curry's corset that she wore on stage. And, you know, there's definitely a connection between that corset and Miley Cyrus on the VMAs. But I believe that Cherie wore her, or bustier is the other term for it, in a much more powerful way. She strutted like an athlete. She was imitating Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror Show. She was almost like a drag artist, is one of the things I argue in my book. So I don't think that she wore it in a really overly sexualized, fetishistic way. I think there was a challenge in her performance. However, this is the danger for women, that as soon as you show your flesh, it's hard for people to see anything else.
But it's not just showing flesh. It's kind of the, I mean, the bustier aside, I mean, the picture on the cover of your book, Queens of Noise, you know, they're wearing, you know, they dress sexily, not just, I mean, I think it's gone to extremes now with Lady Gaga and Rihanna. I mean, Miley Cyrus aside, because I don't think people, you know, I don't know, I'm going to say people don't want to take Miley Cyrus very seriously as a, I don't think she's earned her chops as an artist necessarily yet. Maybe she will. But, you know,
right.
But Rihanna or Lady Gaga or Katy Perry, those are respected rock artists, and yet they're still really, you know, strippers to a to a large extent.
Well, they, you know, certainly the strip pole has become an unfortunate accessory in live acts. And look, I mean, rock and roll is a term for sexuality. Rock and roll was always sexual. You know, Elvis Presley, you know, was censored for shaking his hips, you know.
Yeah.
The Runaways certainly didn't invent this. What they did was try to express it from teenage girls' points of view, wearing the clothes that were sort of current at that time and that you would find girls wearing in clubs. That, you know, they weren't wearing anything worse than what a lot of just fans were wearing, or just, you know, the whole glam scene had this kind of look. The men were wearing corsets and such in glam.
Well, I mean, there's no denying the double standard of it, but do you think that critical response to the work of the Runaways or to female artists in general is affected by the sexploitation aspect?
Certainly they had trouble being taken seriously, because people thought that they were a novelty act, or they were just being marketed as jailbait, and people didn't necessarily search below the image to listen to the music. That was definitely a struggle for them, and they themselves sort of changed the way that they looked and tried to rein in some of that sexploitation as their career went along. I think they didn't realize how much it was going to control the dialogue about them. And, you know, if you look, and, you know, after Cherie left the band, the other members in the first concert mockingly wore T-shirts with corsets on them. So, you know, they were very aware of what they had been reduced to. Unfortunately, you know, to a degree, the pony had left that stall, and they weren't going to be able to alter that completely. People started yelling at really rude things to them at their shows from that point on.
Like what type of things? what kind of things did they yell at them?
Well, let's see. Which of the ones can I say on the air?
That's okay. We're on.
Get it off. Trying to get them to show their breasts. Kind of what we've now, you know, words that have become famous from wet T-shirt contests were trotted out for the runaway shows.
Well, Courtney Love used to actually do that in the middle of a show. She would reveal a breast or two.
Hey, men take their shirts off in shows. All I mean, Robert Plant. What would he have
That's
done
right.
if he wasn't?
That's right. He doesn't. He doesn't unbutton his shirt anymore, though. I noticed.
Thank God.
Well, you know, in terms of their being taken seriously, the Runaways being taken seriously, they've been compared to the Monkees, and I happen to love the Monkees, but the comparison comes from the idea that they weren't an organic origin to the group, that they were cast after responding to an ad in the trades. You know, also of the four Monkees, two were musicians and two were actors. So is that a fair comparison, the Monkees and the Runaways?
It's not completely unfair, but it's not completely accurate either. They did not organically emerge from, you know, living next door to each other or going to the same school and playing in their parents' garage. They did find each other primarily with the help of a charismatic, controversial figure named Kim Fowley, who was a music industry semi-legend by the time he came up with the idea of an all-girl band. Kim had been looking. He placed an ad in a newspaper looking for an all-girl band. Nobody answered, so that ad did not exactly form the Runaways. But a year later, he did eventually find the five women or young women who he would name the Fabulous Five and the Runaways. They all really did. They were not actresses. They did know how to play their instruments. Some of them were quite accomplished and had been in other bands, Sandy West and Lita Ford in particular. And some of them were really quick studies.
Yeah. Well, Kim Fowley is certainly an interesting person and plays a prominent role in your book, The Queens of Noise. We're chatting with Evelyn McDonald. She's the author of this book about the Runaways called Queens of Noise. You know, when you were talking about the decisions that the band made, and that maybe the decisions that they made were not the best decisions for them in the long run, in terms of commercial success or not just commercial success, but I guess commercial success allows for the band to stay together and so forth. And that was because there really wasn't an adult. I mean, they were teenagers when they formed their band. And,
right.
And the guy who was giving them advice was maybe not such a great person to be giving them advice.
No. And, you know, Kim Fowley, you know, did not want to necessarily be their manager. He wanted to be more of a producer type. He actually hired someone to be their manager, and that person just ended up sleeping with the members of the band or some of the members of the band and getting one of them pregnant and reputedly giving them drugs, according to Cherie Currie and her autobiography. They were young. They were minors, and they were thrust into this crazy situation, and of course they loved it and they embraced it, but they could have used some better advice and supervision than Kim Fowley provided, certainly, or that Scott Anderson, the temporary manager.
The one who slept with all of them?
All of them but one. And because she turned him down.
So she used birth control then. Oral contraception. She said no. Isn't it a crime that he slept with them? I mean, they were under 18, right?
Yes, it would have been a crime at the time, actually.
And is there a statute of limitations on that such crime?
There
I don't
is
know.
A statute of limitations. It has run out. I did research this. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's long expired. Uh-huh. But yes, he actually, if it's true that he slept with them at the time that they say that he did, some of them were underage. I think some of them were 18.
You know, that's another interesting thing that you just dropped in there, Evelyn McDonald. In your book, there are conflicting stories from all the people involved. How do you know? Who do you believe? And I'm sure you believe somebody.
Right. Well, you know, there are some stories, some incidents that the points of view are so different that it is hard for me to know for sure exactly what happened. So in those cases, I just tried to present what everybody said about the incident, and I tried to find documentation for as much of it as I could. There was an infamous incident that Cherie calls Kim Fowley's sex education class, where he performed masturbation on a young woman in front of members of the band. He denies this. Some members of the band don't remember it at all. Some swear that it happened. Certainly, some of the Cherie Curry talks about in her book. Some of the information in her book is not accurate. Doesn't match up with the dates of shows. But those are kind of details. I couldn't recreate being in that hotel room. I don't know what happened. All I could do was say, well, here's the dates when it could have happened and where it could have happened. And here's what everybody says about it. There were several incidents like that. Even the famous way in which the song Cherry Bomb gets written, or the story of how they find Cherie Curry in a teen bar, I found things that contradicted that. I think there was a lot of myth-making. It was the 70s. It was rock and roll. People wanted to have a good story, and I don't want to take that fun away. I didn't want to be the total killjoy. So sometimes I presented the story as it has been told, and then I raised some question marks.
Right, because your subtitle, The Real Story of the Runaways, because the story has been told. Now it's been on film. There's been a documentary film as well as a dramatic film and a couple of other
right.
books. So how does your story, why is your story the real one? How does it differ from the ones that have been told?
Well, the two films that have been out, the first one being Edge Play, which is Vicky Blue's documentary, Victory Tischler Blue is her full name. She was one of the bass players in The Runaways. It's her interview with several members of the band, but most notably missing is Joan Jett, who did not cooperate with it, who's, of course, the founding member of the band, one mm-hmm. of the two founding members, and a huge part of the story. So that piece was missing. And then from The Runaways, the feature film by Floria Sigismondi, that's based on Cherie Curry's book, and it's pretty much Cherie and Joan's story. The other members of the band are really either completely left out of it or largely left out of it. And it takes a lot of liberty with the facts. I liked the movie. It was a good story. It's true to a lot of the spirit of what happened to the band, but it acts as if the band broke up when Cherie left, which is not at all true. They went on to record two more studio albums. So I was really trying to create a document that told everybody's point of view. The ones that were missing from either movie, and put them all together and told the whole story. Didn't stop when Cherie left, or didn't start when Vicky joined the band, tried to cover it all. And then also talk about what happened to them afterwards, which is really fascinating, from Joan Jett becoming the rock and roll star that we know to Jackie Fox, one of the bass players, becoming a Harvard-trained entertainment lawyer.
And she learned a lot, I guess, from all the mistakes that the band made when they were kids.
Yeah, I think she had some good incentive for trying to figure out how the music industry works.
We're chatting with Evelyn McDonald. She's the author of Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways, and her work has appeared in Rolling Stone and the New York Times and then lots of other worthy publications. And she also has a nice little blog called Populism, right? Populism?
Yeah, Populism blog, WordPress.com.
Yeah, I like that blog a lot.
Thank you.
The Queens of Noise paints a really vivid portrait of Los Angeles in the mid-70s. Can you talk a little bit about that scene that gave birth to the Runaways?
Right. So this is Los Angeles after decades of exponential growth and being, you know, the destination on the West Coast where everybody's going to join the aerospace industry or to make it big in Hollywood. But that starts to turn in the 70s. And, you know, the beautiful beach blanket Babylon is starting to decay. There's been Charles Manson. There's been the Watts riots. So the Runaways come into what's supposed to be this bucolic or picturesque setting, and it maybe it's not as picturesque anymore. They come from all over this vast exopolis, as people call it, from the different suburbs that are, you know, over an hour's drive from each other, so that Joan takes four buses to go to the first rehearsal with drummer Sandy West. And then they come together in Hollywood, in West Hollywood in particular, which on the Sunset Strip, which is, you know, infamous site for rock and roll, the Doors and Frank Zappa, and everybody hangs out on the Strip. It's where the glam scene, Rodney's English Disco, it's on the Sunset Strip. But it's that scene is also starting to become a little seedy. The groupies have taken over. There's a lot of quaaludes. It's a time of great freedom, and it's a bohemian outpost, and it's a place for outsiders, whether they're, you know, gay or escaping from abusive parents. It's a place where actual runaways did go, runaways with a small R, not a big R, to escape and to find themselves and to express themselves. But there was also a lot of crazy stuff going on, let's say. A lot of young groupies sleeping with older rock stars. And so there's that weird context for the Runaways, too. And in a way, the Runaways were young girls empowering themselves and not sleeping with the rock stars, but deciding to be the rock stars.
Yeah, that's the cool part.
Yeah, exactly. That was, you know, and it was partly Kim Fowley's great idea, you know. Get the girls up there on the stage.
The 1970s, you know, it's a more diverse musical era than almost any other. I mean, the 60s had a lot of great music, and so did the 80s, but I don't think any era saw the rise of so many desperate musical styles. You got the singer-songwriter, the country rock thing, and disco and funk and new wave and punk, and it's just fascinating to look back at it now. And I think in Queens of Noise, you approach the Runaways not only as a journalist, but also as a fan. You enjoyed the band.
Absolutely. I was just looking at videos today. I'm actually teaching Runaways to one of my classes at LMU, and I was just looking at the videos going, oh my gosh, look at how beautiful they were and strong and confident on that stage at that time. I mean, they were as sexy and bold and fun as Led Zeppelin, probably more so at that time. Led Zeppelin was getting old and shaggy.
Well, videos and YouTube and all that, it's kind of, that's how we look at things now. But what if I was over at your house and you wanted to play me a record back in 1976, 75, 76, and you said, oh, you got to hear this record by the Runaways. Which record, what track would you play to convince me that I should be a Runaways fan?
Oh, there's many, but I guess one of my favorite Runaways songs that should have been a hit is American Nights, which is off their first album. And it's just a great anthem about kids partying. Springsteen could have sung it. The Hold Steady, it could be their theme song. Great, just should be a classic on classic rock.
That was The Runaways with American Nights. And we're talking with Evelyn McDonald. She's the author of a new book about the Runaways called Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. That was a good track.
But Mercury refused to release it as a single.
They didn't want to do a second single, you said, from the record.
They released Cherry Bomb as the first single. It lived up to its name and bombed. And they said, forget it, let's do a set. You know, they still did fund actually two more albums, but they didn't release another single. It's a mystery to me.
And then they had this amazing thing happen when they went to Japan.
They were mobbed. They were huge in Japan. It was a form of Beatlemania. They were greeted at the airport by screaming fans. You know, all the text, like, you know, it was a hard day's night come to life for them. They were on TV. They were just treated like celebrities. They were there for a month. They recorded probably their best album, which is a live album, which Mercury also refused to release in the United States. It was the validation that they'd always sought. They had singles on the radio and that went to the top of the charts. And their albums sold well too.
Do they still have fans over there?
Oh, absolutely. They still have fans around the world. And they have really devoted, dedicated fans. I actually wanted to write about that because I think the fans have done a lot to keep the legend of the Runaways alive, have worked really hard and actually, you know, physically supported the members and helped them out over the years. I get emails from Australia, from Germany, from Brazil, of people who, you know, have found the book and love the Runaways.
Well, you know, the Led Zeppelin, they kind of, for some reason, they have, like, maintained this ever-present thing among young people. Every boy who turns 16 suddenly becomes a Led Zeppelin fan.
Right, right.
And is that happening with Runaways? Are there young people who are discovering them?
I think that is happening, actually. And, of course, the movie and having that it starred Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning is helping that. But, yes, I get a lot of women who are very young also emailing me. I assume they've pretty much discovered the Runaways through the movie. But, you know, like I said, Miley Cyrus is a big Runaways fan. She performs Cherry Bomb live also. So
Oy.
I think, yeah, I know. but, you know, I think there's something that it does really appeal to. I mean, it's an anthem for teenage girls. You know, it's the great, daring sexual tease song for teenage girls. So I hope every generation discovers it. You know, and before this generation, it was the Riot Girls of the early 90s that discovered the Runaways and Bratmobile recorded Cherry Bomb. And
that's been covered by a few bands, hasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's definitely the most just covered, most it featured in soundtracks and TV shows.
You mentioned Hard Day's Night. Well, don't you think they kind of missed an opportunity? That would have been a perfect thing. I mean, even the Spice Girls made a Spice Girls movie. It would have been the perfect thing for them to make a movie where they were acting in it, you know? That would have been great. That might have put them over the top.
There was one that they were supposed to make towards the end of their career, and it's actually really part of what broke them up because Lita and Sandy did not want to make it, and Joan did. It was called Mama, We're All Crazy Now. It was completely modeled after A Hard Day's Night. It's kind of a mess. I have the script. I think there was other people saw that as a possibility too, but the problem was that it continued to this idea that they were just sort of cartoon characters and not taking them seriously, that they were really desperate to be taken seriously after the sort of backlash to their jailbait image.
They also didn't help their cause because they were young and because they would say things that they would have been wiser not to say out loud, and that they, you know, would I guess coming out and trashing the Ramones and Patti Smith, probably not the best career move.
No, that was not a good career move, and that was in one of their first major articles. And yeah, that went over like a Led Zeppelin in for the New York media, which Patti Smith and Ramones were gods to them. So yeah, that was probably not one of their swifter moves. And they went on to tour with the Ramones, so clearly they mended that fence.
The Ramones
I don't
didn't
know if
have the
they.
grudge.
No, no. And Lenny Kaye from the
Patti
Patti Smith
Smith.
group also supported them. I don't. I had a feeling Patti never really came around. She hated the Runaways. That's
Well,
okay. She didn't like Debbie Harry either.
she didn't like what? I'm sorry?
Patti Smith didn't like Debbie Harry either.
That's right. Because they were
Girls don't
rivals.
have to get along.
Well, the book is called Queens of Noise, and the author is Evelyn McDonald. She also has a blog, and if you Google her, you'll find it. And it's a great, great book. I think you will all enjoy it, whether or not you are fans of the Runaways like Evelyn McDonald and I are. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com, and you can also find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Evelyn McDonald. Her new book, Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.